Randall Goosby calls Memphis home, but he's lived in a lot of different places. And he would commute from Memphis to New York City to study with Itzhak Perlman. He first attended Perlman's intensive summer music program in 2011, and that was just the beginning. He continues to study with Perlman, who's really helped him to shape his values as a professional musician, and I guess just as an incredible human being, too. Randall has just released his new recording. In fact, it's his debut. It's called Roots. You'll hear more about it this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Macher. Randall, right as we were starting to visit, you mentioned your brother's practicing cello in the other room. Tell me about your family, your talented family. Is it just you and your brother? Do you have other siblings?
It's my brother and my sister as well. I'm the oldest of three, and my brother is a very talented cellist who's enrolled at the Manhattan School of Music currently. My sister has the ability to play the flute. She wasn't quite as passionate about making a life and career out of it. She has since gone on to graduate from Swarthmore with a major in Japanese, and she's awaiting clearance to go over to Japan for a couple of years to teach English there. So she is artistic at heart, but I think her mind is a little bit more sort of on the academic side of things. But we've all been involved with music since we were almost babies. I think it was when I was six, my brother was two, and my sister was four, that my mother sort of, she told us, like, I'm going to make you guys play an instrument, but I'll let you choose what instrument you want to play. So they both chose piano, and they started at that tender age. And I also actually started on piano because we were briefly steered away from the violin by someone who thought my hands were too small and I was too young to learn, even though we didn't know at the time that most, you know, world-class string players, violinists especially, start at the age of two or three or four. So that's how it all sort of started, but we've all been musically inclined since then, I guess.
You mentioned that your sister has a degree in Japanese, and you grew up in Japan. Can you tell me a little bit about that, how that happened, how you ended up growing up in Japan?
Well, I actually didn't grow up in Japan. My mom is the one who grew up, was born and raised in Japan, and we made several trips over there when we were young, and I actually spoke very fluent Japanese as a child. From the time I was about one year old to when I was about five or six, we were living in Philadelphia, and I was enrolled in a sort of Japanese, like, Saturday school. So I would go there on weekends and, you know, be speaking Japanese with my friends and teachers there. And of course, I would come home and want to practice with my mom. So I think that Japanese was sort of my first language, actually. I think my first word may have been in Japanese. But when we moved away from Philly, we moved to Jacksonville, Florida, where the community was a little bit less diverse, and there certainly wasn't any Japanese school that I could enroll in. So I lost it pretty quickly. My mom still gives me a hard time about that because, you know, as things start to get busier and busier, and as I start to perform more and more, it's inevitable that eventually I'll end up in Japan and I'll have to be able to speak. So I'm doing my best to try and ramp that back up.
Well, your sister will be there, so maybe she can be on hand.
There you go. Yeah, my sister and my mom will take care of the translating if I can't pick up my end of the bargain.
Tell me about your parents, because they have a very diverse background, which obviously has influenced you.
Certainly, yeah. Well, as I mentioned a little earlier, my mom was born and raised in Osaka, Japan, and my dad was born in Sacramento, grew up in the Bay Area. He actually ended up participating in the same program that my sister is about to start. It's called the JET program, and it's a sort of a postgraduate program in Japan where American students can go there and teach English and, you know, be immersed in the language and the culture and the community. And I think they actually met in Japan during my dad's time in that program. It's a pretty funny story, and my dad's always very happy to tell it, but I guess they were in some kind of bar or restaurant, and my dad was there with one of his colleagues from the program, and he looked over at a table in the middle of the restaurant and saw my mom there with you know, a few of her friends. He hadn't met her at this point, but he was absolutely just taken by her. And he turned to his friend and he was like, I'm going to go talk to her. So very brave of him in a country that, you know, he probably hadn't spent more than a few months in. But she actually ended up getting up to go to the bathroom. And he decided to go and sit in her seat while she was gone and started speaking in Japanese. He's also fluent in Japanese. To all of her friends who were shocked, she comes back very, very upset that somebody's sitting in her seat. She couldn't understand why this was happening. So, you know, he pulls up a chair and they start talking, and that's sort of how it went down. But, you know, in terms of their, you know, artistic sides of their brains, you know, my mom was always, you know, an avid singer, and she always loved music, playing piano, and she danced a bit when she was growing up as well. She actually sort of kind of learned English when she finally came here for college through like R&B and Motown tunes. And my dad obviously is fluent in Japanese, but he was, you know, he grew up listening to, you know, all kinds of different music, everything from, you know, experimental jazz to R&B and hip hop and everything in between. So a few different musical influences, but none of them were classical, which is why it's kind of a mystery how all three of their kids sort of got into it. But I don't know, maybe I can take a little bit of credit for that.
Randall, did you also spend some time in Memphis growing up?
I did, yeah. I sort of claim Memphis as my hometown and sort of where I grew up. We spent the most time there out of all the places that we've lived. I guess we moved to Memphis when I was just about to start middle school. So I was about 11 or 12 years old, and then we stayed there all the way up until maybe even a couple of years after I went to college at Juilliard. But yeah, I call Memphis home. I miss it so much. We now live in Virginia Beach, which is beautiful, and there's great golf here. But the food in Memphis is really the cornerstone, or was the cornerstone of my experience there, at least. On top of the fact that, of course, I had made and still keep in touch with some great friends from Memphis. But you know, not much of my musical journey actually took place in Memphis. I was there and participated in the Memphis Youth Symphony for several years. Before I first attended the Perlman Music Program, Itzhak Perlman's intensive summer music school in 2011, I believe it was. And beyond that point, I started traveling to New York every week to study with him. So I found myself sort of splitting my time almost between Memphis and New York after so many years. But yeah, Memphis has a big place in my heart, and I can't wait for the first opportunity I have to go back and, first of all, eat, but also connect with some old friends.
Itzhak Perlman has also become a mentor to you. I mean, I know you were in his program, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you might continue to develop a relationship with him. How did that come about?
The way I see it is a stroke of luck. You know, I certainly didn't believe that I was, you know, capable of whatever level of playing I thought was necessary to be accepted into his program. I was very fortunate to have been accepted, and that was really, you know, a turning point in my mind as far as, you know, whether or not I was going to take music seriously or even continue playing, actually, at that point. I was coming out of what was at first a very, very productive and well-oiled sort of machine, which was that my mom and I would go to New York once a month to have lessons with another excellent touring soloist, Philippe Quint. But we could only go up there once a month, and the sort of inconsistency of not having lessons every week, I think, started to take its toll on me after a few years. And I began to get discouraged, and I really noticed that my progress was slowing. So having seen that, Philippe strongly suggested that I apply for Mr. Perlman's program. I got in, and within the first several days, I mean, I was absolutely shocked at the level of artistry and musicianship and passion that every student displayed there. It was something that I hadn't been around before firsthand, something that I didn't really know existed. And within the first week, I mean, that was it. I knew that this was what I wanted to, you know, build my life around, and I still have, you know, keep in close contact with many of those great friends that I made that very first summer. And following that, my parents actually took it upon themselves to get in touch with the Perlmans, mostly because they hadn't heard from me throughout the first maybe 5-6 weeks of the festival, because I was having such a great time. They sort of wanted to know if I was behaving myself and whatnot. But the Perlmans were sort of aware of the fact that I was in between teachers, sort of. And they sort of took me under their wing, and I auditioned for the pre-college program, where I began studying with Mr. Perlman, as well as Catherine Cho, who he teaches in tandem with quite often. And that was the beginning of our relationship. You know, I obviously saw quite a bit of him and his wife over those 3 years in pre-college, and it was a very natural transition into his studio in the college program. And it's continued to grow, and I'm really grateful to have not only a musical and violinistic icon in my life like him, but also someone who I really can relate to in a way, it just in terms of life as a musician and a performer, and the sorts of things you think about and consider, not only in relation to the music, but also in relation to how you are feeling, about the music, about what it is that you're doing, and how to most accurately and effectively convey what it is that you're feeling through the music. So it's really a blessing to have a relationship like this.
You earned your undergrad and graduate degrees at Juilliard, and now you're working on an artist diploma, is that right? With
Correct.
Perlman and Catherine Cho. What will that additional diploma allow you to do?
Well, it'll allow me to continue taking lessons. I very much still feel that, I'm a student of the instrument, I'm a student of the music, and I feel like I still have so much to learn and so much to refine in my playing and in my artistry. But the sort of the point of the artist diploma program is to allow students to continue taking lessons, but still have the time and the allowance of being able to travel and carry out a performance schedule. So this past year obviously was not really that. I had virtual lessons for the entire year through Zoom, which worked surprisingly well. I still learned a great deal, but I'm really looking forward to getting back into the studio and working with Mr. Perlman and Ms. Cho in person. They've never ever been short of guidance and wisdom and just a sense of assurance as far as what I'm going through and what I'm thinking about and what I'm practicing. So having the opportunity to sort of pick their brains a little bit more, I should say, while at the same time traveling and performing and really sort of getting used to this sort of professional lifestyle is huge. It's really an incredible opportunity, and very thankful that Juilliard hasn't gotten tired of me after 10 years. They've let me back for another 2 years.
You're also involved in a few community engagement projects. I don't know how well that worked during COVID, but I know that that's been really important to you. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Absolutely. Community engagement is sort of what I've come to define as my purpose with music. This is not something that I do simply for my own enjoyment, although it's sort of my life, but I've taken it upon myself to really commit to inspiring and sort of bringing on board the next generation of young people and trying to open their eyes to all of the joys and opportunities and the values that lie within a life and a career and in music. Whether or not you want to make it a career, I think it's an invaluable experience, especially as a young formative mind. But these community engagement projects have been part of my life for several years now. Most recently, I've partnered with UK Music Masters. It's an organization in the UK, obviously, that goes into primary schools in the area and pairs teachers with students in group classes. And basically, their mission is to celebrate and increase the level of diversity and inclusion and accessibility for music education specifically. And so that was right in line with what I'm trying to accomplish with my work and with my music. Prior to that, I was involved with a couple of nonprofits in the New York City area, one of which was Opportunity Music Project, which has a similar mission to UK Music Masters, just maybe not on quite as large a scale. But I was teaching a small studio of private students from lower income households in the greater New York City area. Mentoring them, they received free instruments, low-cost lessons, and I got to be a part of a couple of years of their development, which was really special for me to see. Teaching is something that I have sort of known and maybe assumed that was in my future, but I, I've never really had a chance to dive in headfirst like that, especially with kids of such a young age who are sort of freshly starting the violin. So it was a real pleasure to connect with them and to see their development even over a couple of years. It was a really great experience for me. And I also have been involved with Concerts in Motion, which is it's kind of removed from the music education facet of what I do, but Concerts in Motion is also a New York City-based nonprofit which connects musicians with elderly or ill, otherwise homebound patrons who love the arts and love classical music, but are no longer able to go out and enjoy it themselves. So we go into their homes and we give them private house concerts. And that was, in and of itself, an incredibly inspiring experience because, some of these patrons were almost unresponsive. They were, either so old or so ill, and sometimes it was a guessing game as far as whether they were actually enjoying or even hearing the music. But almost every time I went in, even if there was a person who was just sitting in their chair sleeping with their eyes closed, you could see, little movements in the hands, and you could see, hints of expression on their faces, and it was really moving for me. So, any opportunity I have to connect with, with a new audience or with a different audience who may not be able to consume and enjoy this art whenever they please is an opportunity that I'm always eager to take.
Randall, you mentioned the values of classical music. Can you share those with me?
Absolutely. I mean, it's probably too long a list to go through right now, but
maybe your two or three top favorites or the ones that you really focus on every day.
Sure. Well, I mean, the first one that comes to mind is a sort of emotional awareness or a vulnerability or an empathy that one has, because one of the great lessons that I've ever gotten from Mr. Perlman was that he said to me, "You have to be moved by the music, as the artist, as the performer. Because if you are not, how can you expect for an audience to be moved by the music?" So, even from a young age, and I tried to enforce is the wrong word. I tried to encourage this with my students while I had them, which is that, what are you trying to say? What do you see? What do you hear when you're listening to this music or when you're playing it? Because the clearer the picture is in your mind as far as what kind of effect this music has on you, the clearer it's going to be for the audience. So that's number one, just having a sense of an awareness, not only of your emotions, but how those emotions sort of relate and correspond with those of people who might be listening. Another one, which is a little bit more on the practical side, is discipline. I mean, in order to really, do great things as a musician of any style or genre, you got to practice. I mean, that's the case for anything else, whether it's music or sports or visual art or writing. The more you do it, the better you get. And the difference, I think, with music and perhaps less subjective tasks or careers is that, it takes a lot of refinement and focus to really achieve an efficient practice session or routine. It can't just be mindless repetition. It has to be mindful, and it has to be purposeful in terms of what it is that you're trying to achieve, what it is you're trying to improve upon. So discipline, you have the emotional awareness and empathy, which I think is so important nowadays, especially. And I guess if I could pick a third point, I think it really has a great effect on our ability to communicate and work with people, to collaborate. This is something I didn't really have a chance to do as a young kid when I was learning sort of still how to play the violin. But once I got into the Perlman Music Program, which chamber music is a huge part of, I began to realize that it's the most fun playing music when you're playing and giving and taking from other people with you. It can be a very solitary lifestyle, being a musician, because you spend at least 3 or 4 hours a day in a practice room by yourself with no one around. But as soon as you have the opportunity to take those skills that you've developed in the practice room and share them and sort of intermix them and intermingle with other musicians, I think that's when you sort of realize what this is all about. That communication factor is something that's really, really special and unique, I think, about classical music specifically.
Randall, you just released your debut recording. It's called Roots. Tell me about the title. Why did you call it Roots?
Yeah, great question. I realized when I searched the album the other day that there are a lot of other albums called Roots. And I'm sure they all have their own special meanings. But for me, you know, Roots has a couple of different meanings for me personally, one of which is obviously my own personal and cultural roots in African-American music and culture and tradition. But it also goes sort of in line with American music, and specifically American classical music, and the sort of genesis point of that, which in many, many cases is Black music and culture, going back to, you know, blues and jazz and as far back to the Negro spiritual. There's a sort of trickle-down effect that has happened over decades by this point, where any popular music genre that we know, country music, hip-hop, R&B, rock and roll, I mean, it's all sort of, it all has taken little bits and pieces from these art forms. And I really wanted to highlight and celebrate the fact that, you know, we came from somewhere, right? And not everyone is really aware of what that place is in relation to music, specifically in pop music. But, you know, as far as American classical music goes, the sound that we sort of associate with American classical music is one that's not often recognized as being derived from Black music and culture. But in fact, the way that I see it and the way that I've tried to sort of put this album together, it really is a sort of chronological trickle-down effect, is what I said just a few seconds ago. And I wanted to really highlight and celebrate that, in addition to the fact that, you know, some of the composers on this album are people who I view as real trailblazers in terms of really paving the way for a young artist of color like myself or anyone else in this day and age to be able to pursue, you know, this life and career without the same kinds of fears and anxieties and doubts that must have been prevalent in Black people even 40 or 50 years ago because of the social climate of this country. So I wanted to draw awareness of these things. And I think all of those things are sort of encapsulated in a title like Roots. So just went with it.
It's interesting to me because oftentimes a young soloist like yourself wouldn't start here with their debut recording. You know, you might start with some of the big concertos or something else. It was this completely your idea to start in this way, your recordings?
Pretty much. This is my first, obviously my debut album, and it's my first year having been associated and signed with an international record label. And, I wasn't exactly sure what direction I wanted to take it. But one of the things that Decca sort of pressed on me from the very beginning was that, you know, we have to tell a story with this disc. And I wanted to tell a story that had not been told before, if not very often. And the stories of a Mendelssohn concerto or a Beethoven concerto or, you know, Bach sonatas, you know, there are many, many, many iterations of those stories. And people have a lot to choose from in terms of listening to those works already. But with considering all that's happened in the past year, especially here in the U.S. with the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement and AAPI hate and all of these cultural, social, almost revolutions, it seems like, I felt that it was important for me to reflect the times in that way. And, you know, I was personally, you know, deeply affected by every single one of the, you know, police incidences of police brutality and murder that we saw on the news every day and that still happen, unfortunately. I just found myself thinking, what the hell can I do about this? You know, I can't just sit at home and keep watching this happen and just be sad about it and be angry about it. And I still am, but having something to channel those feelings into is really important. And I'm really grateful for the opportunity for this project, because it was really a healing process for me. A lot of people were focused on, you know, you probably saw the hashtag amplify Black voices or amplify melanated voices. And that's exactly what I wanted to do with this project, and to show people in a way that, look, we're here. You know, we've always been here. We always will be here. Look what we can do. You know, look what we've done. Look at this great art that has been produced that no one knows about, right? Because it's not in the canon of classical music or whatever you want to call it. This is great art. And this is the stuff that really changes lives. And it's powerful stuff. And considering the lives and experiences of many of the composers on this album, to think what they went through and the challenges they had to overcome, and yet they still were able to produce this incredible music, is incredibly humbling and inspiring, to say the least. So really grateful for the opportunity.
When you were just 13, I believe, you performed with the New York Philharmonic at a young people's concert. Is that how you met Sanford Allen?
No, I actually met Sanford Allen through Sphinx. I first participated in the competition in 2010, and the following year, as a part of their annual Sphinx Virtuosi Tour, I was asked to play the last movement of Perkinson's Blues Forms, which appears on the album. And Sanford Allen, the dedicatee of that piece, was generous enough to spend some time with me and work on that movement prior to that performance. So I met him then, and we've sort of kept in touch since then. I had the opportunity to play Blues Forms in its entirety for him prior to recording the album. I think it was really important for me to have a sense of his perception of the piece and his perspective on it, so that I could sort of pay tribute in a more meaningful way. I didn't want to just take this piece and do with it what I would. I sort of wanted it to be a little bit more of an informed interpretation. Needless to say, I don't think our recordings are the same, if not, as you know, similar in terms of the way that we approach the piece. But you know, I was very inspired by his interpretation, his recording of the piece, as well as, again, you know, his experience and being the very first and only at the time Black violinist in New York Philharmonic. As well as the first, you know, part of the inaugural class of young concert artists, a management agency who I've been associated with for a couple of years. Just the difference in our experiences puts things into perspective for me a little bit. So, you know, I was really inspired by his story and his work.
This release also includes world premiere recordings of music by Florence Price. In 2009, some of her manuscripts were rediscovered in her former Illinois home. Can you tell us what was unearthed and what you feature on this recording?
Absolutely. I believe that all three of the works on this recording were unearthed in that collection of music. The two fantasies for violin and piano, and also Adoration, which was originally written for organ but arranged by Elaine Fine for violin and piano. She's such a special composer, I think, and one that deserves all the recognition that she's only now starting to get. A woman of many firsts, sort of a female counterpart to someone like a Grant Still, who was the first, you know, Black person to have a piece performed by a major American orchestra, first Black woman to have a piece performed. And, you know, I think that the incredibly vast range of influences that she brings into her music is very, very unique, and it's very personal. You know, I think for the fantasies in particular, they're so quickly moving through, you know, different harmonic areas and different textures and different styles almost entirely. You know, she goes from this really virtuosic, rhapsodic opening sort of a rhythmic dancing type of feel with that's sort of infused with these chromatic, sort of crawling, late romantic European harmonies. And then again, she goes back to basically a violin piano setting of a spiritual. All within a matter of, you know, a couple of minutes. And I think this is something that's so unique to her, and she does it so effectively. But it takes a good deal of thought and decision-making from the performers, because in music where it's not exactly clear where you're going, you have to be able and be ready to switch gears immediately and really commit to that new character, or really commit to the character where you're about to go. And it's interesting because adoration is very different. It's very serene all the way through. It's one texture, pretty much. There's a violin line and there's a piano line, and they both sort of are in harmony pretty much throughout the entire thing. And what's remarkable to me about adoration in particular is that, as you know, I mean, adoration is literally defined as a deep love and respect. And considering what she went through in her life, having had to apply to the New England Conservatory and list her ethnicity as Mexican, so that she would be accepted to the school. She knew that they wouldn't accept black students. So she went there and studied and earned a degree and came back to her hometown of Little Rock, Arkansas to teach, having just a few years later had to move away, move her family up north to Chicago, just because the South was not a safe place for black people, for no other reason than their skin color. You know, I for one would have a lot of hard feelings about an experience like that, but for her to have had that and still be able to channel feelings of adoration into such a beautiful piece is really powerful to me. And again, it just puts things into perspective, the power of art and the power of one's own voice, which she was able to really inject into this music so meaningfully. It's really special. And for me, it's humbling, and it's really inspiring to have a chance to record these works for the first time.
Tell me about the pianist who joins you on this recording.
Gladly. So Ju Wong is the pianist, and he's a good friend of mine now of a couple of years. We met at Juilliard, and he's a really special musician, as I think you can probably tell from the recording. So honest and so sincere and so committed to whatever it is that he plays. Really, really such a fun time recording this with him. I remember the first time I heard him play was during a studio class at Juilliard, where, you know, a studio of my studio mates, violinists would, you know, a couple of us every week will play something for the class in pursuit of some comments and feedback from our classmates. And I remember Ju played, I think it was a Mozart sonata, I can't remember which one it was, but At the end, I was a little bit worried because I realized I hadn't been listening to the violinist at all. I was so tuned into what Ju was doing and was so moved by his playing. Luckily, I wasn't asked to comment. I wasn't asked to provide feedback, so I kept quiet. But I heard him again in a master class, a cello master class, and he was playing a Beethoven cello sonata. And the teacher was trying to get something out of the cellist in a particular phrase, and Ju plays that same phrase right before the cellist has it. And he was struggling to get the cellist to do what he was asking. And eventually he just said, "Hey, Ju, what are you doing? How are you playing it like that?" And Ju said something so innocent and simple, just like, "Oh, I'm just feeling it. I'm feeling the music and I feel the direction of the phrase going here." And the teacher just goes, looks at the cellist and goes, "Yeah, why don't you do that? That seems to work." And at that point I was like, okay, I got to play with this guy. And this was right before I started to get dates for my sort of debut season with YCA. And I asked him out of nowhere, I don't think he had even met me before. And I was like, "Hey man, you're awesome. Let's play together. I have a bunch of recitals." And he just said yes. And that's just kind of the guy he is. You know, I guess it's just, that sounds fun. Let's do it. I'm all in. And we've had probably 50, 60 concerts together over the past couple of years. And we've only grown closer as collaborators, but of course also as friends. And I know he's going to start getting busy too, because he's just joined the Young Concert Artist roster as well. So he'll have his own concerti and recitals to play. But hopefully we can keep up some sort of performance schedule together, because it's just so much fun to work with him.
You and your double bassist on this recording are also good friends and collaborators, and I'd love for you to tell me about how the two of you first met, and then also let's talk about the opening piece on this recording, which he wrote.
Xavier and I, we go way back. We've known each other for about a decade now, I think it is. We met at the 2010 Sphinx competition, where I won the junior division. Obviously, in a competition setting, there's not a whole lot of interest between competitors in terms of getting to know each other and mingling. You know, we're all sort of focused. But thankfully, the following year in 2011, we got to meet again at the Perlman program when I first attended. And he was also there that summer. And I remember he kind of shocked everyone, because I don't think, you know, people don't usually think about double bass as this like rhapsodic solo instrument, right? It's usually, you know, holding down the bass section in an orchestra, or it's, you know, it's playing some kind of walking bass line in a jazz ensemble. But I mean, this guy pulled such a personal and beautiful sound out of the bass. Not to mention, he has impeccable technique. I mean, he can play anything on the bass. He can play violin concertos on the bass, I'm pretty sure. And I was so struck by that, and I was, you know, it wasn't until a few years after that, I think, that he really seriously started to get into composing. And every time I heard one of his compositions, I was like, wow, I gotta play with this guy. And I actually had a couple of opportunities over the past several years, but unfortunately our schedules just didn't align and I wasn't able to do it. So, you know, when we were putting this album together, we understood pretty immediately that it was very important to include a living African-American composer in this sort of lineage that we were putting together. And Xavier was the first name that popped into my head because I've been wanting to work with him for so long. He was pretty much immediately interested, and I really didn't give him that much instruction for this piece because I wanted it to be as natural and organic a reflection of his voice as possible. So I sort of told him, you know, I'm really into like really sort of rhapsodic but rhythmic kind of bluesy stuff, you know, very, very vague in general. And he produced this piece. I mean, this was its first and only iteration as far as I know. He sent me the music, we rehearsed it a couple of times, and we got in the studio and we recorded it for the album. And it's a really special piece. Obviously, it's called Shelter Island, which is an homage to our time together on Shelter Island for the Perlman Music Program. So there's a little bit of nostalgia in that sort of, in that main theme in the middle. And, you know, it always brings back memories for me of Shelter Island in the beach and the you know, the beautiful foresty campus that we're so blessed to have there. And it also is a nod to, like, some music that we all enjoyed back then, some pop music. There's influence from bluegrass, which Xavier has a little bit of a background in. There's some solo Bach in there. I mean, it's sort of similar to Price. There's a lot going on, and it happens so seamlessly and so naturally that you almost don't catch it sometimes. But it's a really, really special piece, and for that reason, I think we had to start off the disc with it. So really, really grateful to have, you know, his voice as a part of this project.
A new recording called Roots. It's the debut work from violinist Randall Goosby. Thanks to Valerie Kaler, our producer of New Classical Tracks. If you're enjoying New Classical Tracks, the best thing you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. And since you're clearly a music fan, let me tell you about another podcast you'll enjoy. It's called the Piano Puzzler Podcast. Each week, host Fred Child invites composer Bruce Adolph into the studio to play one of his brilliant musical mind games. Bruce takes a familiar tune and disguises it in the style of a classical composer. And then a contestant calls in to try to solve the riddle. It's a lot of fun. If you're up for the challenge, subscribe to the Piano Puzzler wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Mocker.